My God, it got brighter.
I think we're supposed to start.
I think, oh my God, it's ticking down.
Yeah.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for coming. My name is Mark Manassi, and you might know my friend here, Dr. Rusinovich. Yes? Oh, come on, give it up. Come on. For a long time, he was just the guy that wrote the great sysinternals tools. And then he got hired by Microsoft back in 06 for, well, I can't disclose the sum, but there are several South American countries who have GNPs that are smaller than that. But I found out recently that he has a new title, and I assumed that that meant, you know how it is, you go to the boss and say, I want a raise, and the boss is like, no, I can't do that. Can you give me a better title? Awesome, yes, we can definitely do that. He got the raise and the title, which is why he is who he is. If I were him, I would be like, Bars, how you doing? Mark Rusinovich, CTO of Microsoft. Like I was actually CTO of all of Microsoft. He could pull it off too, you know? Anyway, so we're here to talk about the cloud. We've done this a few times. Have you ever heard me talk? You guys know who I am? Anybody? Oh, thank you. So I'm something of a cloud Gnostic. You know, I'm not a big believer in the cloud. And Mark, of course, is one of the architects of doing really, really cool stuff. He was on the Windows team for a really long time, but as we know, nothing interesting in Windows has happened for the last 4 years. And did I say that out loud? Jesus, I'm screwed now. So he went over to the Windows team, to the Azure team when it got started. And the fun part, how many of you use something like Azure? Some kind of Azure, a little bit? What drives me crazy is a guy who speaks about things, is that if I ever want to do a talk about Azure and I get a screenshot, right, of the Azure portal, it had better be 2 days old, because like every time you blow your nose, there's something new on the Azure portal, right? You're not all laughing because you don't do Azure, but trust me, when you... So we're going to talk. It's not just Mark talking, it's me too. Sorry, get over it. And so I will be interviewing Mark about the cloud. Would you like to say something to open, Dr. Rusinovich?
I want to thank everybody for coming. I hope we've got an entertaining and informative talk today. We thought that with this... is the second time we did this. We did this at TechEd US in North America, and it was well received. We cover a variety of topics, and Mark is here kind of representing the voice of you guys and going to give me a hard time about a bunch of things, I think.
That is so not true.
And then I'll give him a hard time, too.
So let me just toss you the first softball. So you saw that we didn't have a tremendous number of people here that are using Azure. But now, I would say...
I think they're shy. Right?
There are Germans in the audience. They're not shy. And, you know, there's legitimate concerns. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the funny thing about the cloud is, if you've ever heard my talk, my degrees, he's a PhD, computer science. My PhD work is in economics. And it gave me an interesting perspective. It gives you an ability. The great thing about being an economist is, like, we and lawyers are the only people in the world who can argue anything, one side or the other, without any preparation. Otherwise, you... No, it's just absolutely true. And so when we look at things like clouds, there's some great things there. Great in the sense that you get economies of scale. That's an economics phrase I think many of us know. That, you know, why should you have three people who focus on running an Exchange server when Microsoft can have 20 people run the Exchange servers for 5 billion people? You know? That's all good stuff. But then the flip side is, well, do we really trust, you know, companies like that? Any company, not Microsoft, anybody, you know? And so my first question for you is, the easy one is, what does the cloud do for me? Why should I not run stuff on premises? It's awfully nice to have the Exchange server administrator within choking distance,
yeah.
Right?
So. So one of the things that we find is that businesses are more and more realizing that their business isn't infrastructure. It isn't building out the infrastructure. It isn't operating the infrastructure. It's actually delivering business value, delivering services to their customers.
And so if I'm Procter & Gamble, my job is to get Windex out or whatever they do, as opposed to being a computer.
That's right. It's marketing. It's marketing Windex. It's supply chain for Windex. It's talking to your retail partners for Windex. It's not building a data center to support all of those activities. And so what these people have decided is that it's actually cheaper to outsource this stuff to organizations. And we've kind of seen the trends for hosting infrastructure in the past. But this is going a step further of not just hosting the infrastructure, but hosting the services on top of those infrastructure, on top of that infrastructure. And one of the benefits that they get out of hosting to cloud, where I think the term cloud, just to be specific about the definition of it, it's there's a lot of cloud washing going on. And just basically anything that supports a VM, people call a cloud. When in fact, if you take a look at the National Institute of Standards definition of cloud in the US, which I think is a relatively good taxonomy of what the cloud is, it includes on-demand access, metered access, multi-tenancy, and those kinds of characteristics, and elasticity, and those kind of characteristics are what really allows this kind of agility that companies can get out of taking advantage of cloud resources. Go ahead.
Can I offer an alternative definition?
Sure.
The one that I think of is something that you used to do on your premises with your machines is now somewhere else that you access over TCP/IP.
Precisely, kind of.
Keep going.
I mean, but I think another key part of it, if you take a look at the Procter & Gamble example, when they've got their own infrastructure and their own data center, and they're running their Windex marketing campaigns on it, they think about, maybe Windex, lots of people want to give Windex as Christmas gifts or whatever, so they have a big marketing campaign. You'd, right?
Well, I think the big value of Windows, of that stuff, is to make the Windows clean, which is a Windows guy you would find.
Yeah, I appreciate that, yeah. Anyway, so they'll have these times when they need to make use of extra capacity to support the load of these kinds of seasonal events. And when you're hosting your own infrastructure, you have to build out for those peaks. This is another benefit of the cloud, that elasticity part, that allows Procter & Gamble to go out to somebody else's infrastructure, scale it out.
Think in terms of Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the easier way. Is that most of the months, and then the bathing suit issue comes out, and, that's
all right. Exactly. Yeah. Tax season.
Exactly.
Another one.
Yeah.
Are
you seeing that, by the way? I mean, I know that people are going to the cloud slowly.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of folks using Azure at this point, and you must see those kind of performance numbers. Are you actually seeing companies that are doing like a tax company goes crazy?
Actually, we see it firsthand at Microsoft. A great example is Xbox Live, for example.
How so?
So Xbox Live is our gaming platform that third-party game developers can use to host multiplayer servers,
right?
Game servers. A great example was Titanfall, which launched earlier this year on Xbox Live. And whenever a game launches, the usage just spikes because all the new gamers are getting their hands on the product, they're playing it. And then you see, inevitably for any game, no matter what it is, a few weeks after the launch, the usage starts to drop off as players go and they get distracted by other things and they've gotten their fill for a while and games come out.
But the really important thing is the first day Titanfall comes out, if it's slow, people are like, this is crap, I'm leaving.
That's right. It can ruin the whole game, just that, not being able to hand that load. It does. And in fact, it has in the past. We've seen examples where games haven't been able to hand the load. And so it's that kind of elasticity for Xbox Live. Another one is Microsoft IT has, back when Microsoft started to realize we wanted to become a services company, Ballmer's telling the MSIT, you guys need to get to the cloud. And so MSIT is looking at what workloads we could move to the cloud first. Yeah. A great one to take advantage of this elasticity was an internal tool called Performance. This is what we do our performance reviews on. And you can imagine that a couple times a year...
Wait. I'm sorry. The Performance Review app actually draws a lot of... Well, I know you have a lot of people, but I thought you were going to say Exchange.
No, Exchange is one, but it's not seasonal like Performance. Performance is like at least with the way that your review system used to work,
yeah.
A couple times a year you sit down with your manager and they get feedback from you and then they go enter it in the tool and you enter what your commitments are. And so for a few weeks a year, that usage of that service just spikes. And MSIT had to build out servers with virtual machines on it to handle those peak times of the year. Otherwise, that server usage would sit there completely idle. So they moved that part of the service to Azure, and now the thing scales out,
nice.
It was using that tool. Nice. They scale out, and then after review period's over, they shut down all the virtual machines, and they're back to being in the pool for use by other applications.
Cool. Very good. So the argument I'm hearing from you is flexibility.
Yeah,
which is interesting, there are many arguments, but you go with less.
Flexibility and the agility of it. So, like I gave that batch demo at the keynote, and batch computing, the ability to scale out versus scale up and take advantage of massive computation. One of our key partners, Towers Watson, they sell this batch computing service on top of Azure. And what they find is that their customers, when they're able to go and run a job in half an hour that used to take 6 hours, what they end up doing is not saying, okay, we've done it, we finished the job, let's wait till tomorrow and do another one. What they do is, oh, let's take the output of that one, let's go run another job to fine-tune it. And they end up basically using more compute and getting more answers because of that agility that they get out of that scale out. So it really changes the way people do business, that ability to take advantage of that massive computation, scale it out, get answers faster, and then get more answers because of that.
Is it affordable, though? I mean, because I remember watching your demonstration at the keynote and thinking to myself, you were giving us, what, a 6 billion IOPS or something like that. And I turned to the guy next to me, and he said to me, what do you think that cost?
Yeah, I heard that.
Like $40,000 a second or
something? It was actually $100,000.
Okay, well, good. It's all right. It's just dollars. It's not euros or anything like that.
So as far as cost, that's a great question. One of the questions that we get when people come to us, customers come to me and say, what does it compare? What's the comparison between cloud costs and on-prem costs? And I turn around and say, what are your on-prem costs?
We don't know.
How many people know what your costs are for on-prem computing? Really broken down into what is the infrastructure, what's the IT, what's all the different aspects that go into it. And very few companies have a good handle on that. In fact, Microsoft ourselves, when we're operating our cloud, we've had to work hard to get a handle on where our costs are, because of course it becomes incredibly important when you're building out massive scale. And if you're misjudging someplace, it can be the difference between losing tens of millions of dollars
Let me ask the crowd a question. How many of you, it's okay, we're not taking names, are a little worried about the cloud in terms of your job? And come on, tell us the truth. That's right. Really, nobody cares? Just a few of you, I see. So one of the most important things that I've said when Mark and I have talked in the past is that Mark's point was spot on. If you don't know what the cost of printing a page is, then you're going to be plowed by the cloud. Because the whole point is, the cloud salespeople are good about numbers and stuff like that. And for many of you, the cloud is the right answer. But the important question is, it's all about numbers, right? Shouldn't it always be about numbers? And that if you can't say it costs so many euros to print a page, or it costs this much, yada, 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 what you're going to find is, how do we get that number? If you and I are running a company, how do we get that? Well, there's the easy part. There's the piece of paper that's easy. There's the toner that's easy. We guess the electricity. But we've also got to add some of your salary and my salary. And how do we do it? As a professional economist, we make shit up, okay? It's not exactly right. But the thing is, anybody doing this, anyone, anywhere, you have to make assumptions. And you can make any assumptions you want as long as they're footnotes in the report that you do. Seriously, you should do that. I'm not saying don't go to the cloud, but I am saying there's really almost no better thing for any organization than to look at that kind of internal cost stuff. And then from there, go to Azure. I had a great experience with Azure. I told you about this just about a month and a half ago. I needed to teach a class to 40 people about PowerShell. They couldn't handle virtual machines on their system. I said, oh crap, what am I going to do? So I sat down, I learned the Azure PowerShell commandlets. And in about a day and a half, 3 days, something like that, somewhere in there, I had a bunch of commandlets where I could just say, how many of you ever taught a hands-on class in IT? Something like that. Anybody? Okay. Well, you know how it is. You're teaching a class. Somebody says, oh, I've done something stupid. I've screwed my machine up. We'll go sit in the corner for an hour and a half until I can fix it. Right? All I had to do was new-dc37, enter. And in about, 3.5 minutes, I had a brand new machine. That's the beauty of the cloud when it works. I've got to get my notes back up here. Okay. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah.
Talk slower.
Well, so it's... I don't know what to talk about now.
Okay, sorry. All right, fine. So you've convinced us, they're convinced that the cloud is a great idea. How many of you are convinced the cloud's a great idea?
Yeah, how many people are still unsure? How many people think...
Come on, tell us if you know, that's right.
Okay.
He's easily hurt, so be careful before you... All right, fine. Okay, so let's say the cloud's a good thing.
Yeah.
There are, I'm told, more than one cloud provider.
Really?
I've heard that. No, I'm always going to think, as you're choosing your cloud vendor, anyway, so That was funny. Why you guys as opposed to the other guys? Amazon, from what I hear, is, you know, it's the 600-pound gorilla, and they've got the presence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Google has the fact that they give stuff away and look at your data, which is good for some reason or something like that. Now, we've heard that you don't.
That's right.
We keep hearing that you don't.
We don't, yeah.
He's smiling when he says that.
No. You know. No,
I know. I know that smile.
So why us? Well, first question, how many of you use Microsoft products in your own enterprise? There we go.
It's tech ed, you Nimrod.
That's why I asked the question.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think the answer, if you're going to look at and strategically partner with a company, one of the benefits of Microsoft, the advantages of Microsoft Cloud, and we talked about this a little bit in the keynote, is that we've got a strong commitment and goal to provide consistency and hybrid connectivity and enable hybrid scenarios with the cloud. Because no matter who you are in this room, no matter how committed or tentative you are about moving to the cloud, it's going to take you a while to get there. I mean, it's some companies will 30, 40 years from now, we'll still have on-prem deployments, even though maybe the bulk of what they're doing is in the cloud. People still have mainframes.
Well, certainly the NSA.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Not necessarily a customer for us.
That you're willing to talk about,
exactly.
I understand.
But during that transition time, as it starts, you're going to want to have consistency of management experience, consistency of development experience, as you develop things, new applications, as you move lift and shift your existing applications to the cloud. You want to be able to manage those consistently with the way you're managing the other on-prem deployments of those applications. Maybe even the application split, like in the case of Microsoft IT. We have part of the application up in the cloud, part of it still on-prem. And going with a model where the cloud vendor is saying, whatever you do on-prem, that's your business, but all we're focused on is the new way of doing things up in the cloud. And good luck with doing that, making that transition and spanning the two. I think is somebody. We're all locked in.
No,
obviously.
I guess that guy wasn't enjoying the presentation. So along those lines.
Yeah.
So when I said to you why cloud, you could have given me a lot of answers, but the answer you gave me was we're elastic. That means you have capacity. Honestly, I've never believed that, and it's not you guys.
Yeah.
No. Seriously. My thought is, yes, it's awesome that I've got some application. That's the thing, is you have to have an application that can scale. We assume that, right? Not everybody does. But, I mean, when Acme or Apex or whatever organization needs to grow, isn't that going to be the same days that everybody else needs to grow? And my fear is, or not my fear, my speculation, is that wouldn't it be the case that when everybody needs, holy crap, more computing, that everybody needs more computing, and so give us some numbers, whatever you can. I mean, are you guys really big enough to handle it?
Of course.
Well, okay. Well, thanks. It's been nice talking with you.
Well, I think this is a key question because some customers come to us and some people say, hey, Mark, my company's relatively small. What's the big deal with this hyperscale that you guys make a lot of noise about? And I'm going to go with a cloud provider, one of these boutique kind of smaller cloud providers, and they'll satisfy my scaling needs just fine. The challenge is that while any individual company's demands might be small, the demands of the group at large are you know, very demanding. And you can't assume that you're not going to end up scaling. One of the examples is this Internet of Things, this big data movement, the analytics that people are doing on their businesses now, the amount of data that they're able to save and process to make better business decisions. If you're going to have to build that, we're seeing an explosion of data. I think that the amount of storage is supposed to double in the next 2 or 3 years, the amount of storage on the planet, just as the volume of data being produced and by 2018. And so
I'm actually surprised. I would have thought that doubled would
be faster than that.
No. Exactly. Yeah.
So when it comes to the us handling the scale, when it comes to your questions like that, we have to be prepared to handle lots of companies wanting to scale out at the same time, and that means we need to build out massive capacity. You don't want to be sitting inside of a cloud provider where you decide you want to scale out just by a few virtual machines, or 10 or 20 or 1,000, and you run up against the wall. I mean, we've already had this growing pains inside of Azure where we've misforecast demand and we've run out of capacity prematurely, and that causes as much, almost as much dissatisfaction as having a cloud outage, because in fact, that's a business outage for the customer. I want to scale out my marketing app to handle the Windex marketing campaign, and I can't, and basically you've just hurt my business. So what we do is we, and this is the benefit of the economies of scale, the more customers we have in there, the more statistical probability that we're going to have that somebody's shrinking at the same time somebody's growing. We also
I've heard some numbers. Brad Anderson spoke to us MVPs last year, I think it was, and said that it was, you know, last year that 17% of the server hardware purchased on the entire planet was purchased by Microsoft. I have heard, seriously, I was like, shit, that's pretty amazing. I have heard, not from him, he can't say these things, that Azure is verging on 1 million servers. That's just 1 million servers. My God, I can barely keep 3 running in my organization. So, it's
and I think that's just the tip of this. Well,
No. My point was, forgive me, but my point was, really, you have 1 million servers and you've actually been stressed over that. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, do you guys ever like come in on a Sunday and say, let's just run some crypto thing that takes 100,000 servers or something?
What do you mean?
I'm saying, it's Sunday. Yeah. Nobody's doing anything. Yeah. So you come in and say, okay, let's crack a PKI.
Oh, on the empty servers?
Yeah, on the empty servers.
No, we do Bitcoin. No, I'm just kidding.
No,
we don't.
Stupid me. No, seriously. So you told us the Titanfall story. I've heard the Titanfall story before. What percentage of Azure servers were awakened for Titanfall?
So that over 100,000 virtual machines were created for Titanfall's launch.
100,000 virtual machines.
100,000 cores, and the virtual machines were typically 4 core virtual machines. So 25,000 virtual machines.
That's moderately impressive. Yeah. And the software scaled across that number of cores.
Yeah.
Damn. Okay.
And that wasn't just in one region. So that's another aspect of this hyperscale. How many of you work at companies that have offices outside of Europe, in Asia, in the United States, in South America? How many of you are European only or a country only? So there's a good mix. But a lot of global companies, if you're a global company, you don't want a cloud that's sitting just in a particular country. You don't want a cloud that's just in one region. You want a cloud that can be everywhere that your customers are. And so this is where that, you know, the number of regions that we talk about becomes an important factor. If you want to reach customers in Southeast Asia, there's got to be a cloud there that can serve them so that they're not talking to cloud services that are halfway across the planet.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, doesn't everybody do that? I mean, I have no idea how many data centers you guys have. It's in the 15, 20, whatever it is. I mean, take Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Isn't Google there? Isn't Amazon there?
Is Google there? Yeah, but
no, they're in China, bowing to their Chinese masters. But still,
the current statistics, we've got 17 active regions around the world. Azure does. Amazon's got 11.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I've always heard that Amazon was bigger than you guys. That they had more systems and all that kind of stuff.
Well, they might have certain regions that are bigger than our biggest region. Like U.S. East is a massive region.
So say it again. They're 11, and you are
17 right now.
Who's
got another 2 announced?
So who also has 17? Does
no, nobody else?
Oh, that's nonsense.
Well, if you take a look at if you take a look at an HP or an IBM, they'll tell you that they've got 150 regions because
they have a machine somewhere.
Exactly. But when it comes to the regions we're talking about are sizable facilities. So again, we need to make sure that somebody that's deploying cloud services in China, South Hong Kong, that when they want to scale out, they can scale out. And we're not sitting there having them come and tell us, hey, we want to scale out by 100 virtual machines tomorrow. They don't have to tell us. They just do it.
So this is a bet you guys are making.
It's a huge bet. I think if those of you that didn't see Satya Nadella's and Scott Guthrie's Cloud Day announcements from last week and a half ago in San Francisco, Satya came out and told the world how much we're spending on data center build-out over the next 12 months. It's $4.5 billion.
That's why the Microsoft dividend is smaller this year? So, So when we talk about a cloud, the easiest thing is to do the Amazon thing, essentially, of saying, I'll create a virtual machine for you. And they do other services, too. Where are you guys on services? If I were to look at Amazon or Google or whatever in terms of number of services. Yeah. I mean, no, it just seems to me that, like, every time I see somebody from Microsoft stand on the stage, it's, hi, let's do some Windows stuff, blah, 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 blah. And in Azure news, we have this is a service, that is a service, this other thing is a service, and there's, like, 15 things in beta.
Yeah. Well, in terms of, you asked your first question about comparison of services,
right.
Google's got very few services at this point. Amazon, of course, had a head start, has probably more
mail, DNS, stuff like that.
When you look at, but when you look at the functionality that we deliver with our services, we're about par now. If you talk to analysts like Gartner and Forrester, they will say we're about roughly on par in terms of capabilities. We go talk to customers, startups, and they say, you know, it used to be we'd look at Amazon and say they've got more services. They've got the services we need. Azure's not quite there yet, and now that's not part of the discussion anymore. So we've already, fleshed out the kind of bare basic set of services that people are looking for as they build out cloud. And we're heading into new areas, like this Cloud ML, like the Cloud Data Factory announcement that we had just yesterday, another service.
Cloud ML?
Cloud Machine Learning.
Oh, I thought that was a markup language.
Yeah.
So, speaking of which, talk to me about Docker. I do some of this stuff because I'm an IT pro and I'm all about automation. You know, PowerShell, I just love PowerShell. I don't exactly get Orchestrator, why we need GUIs to create, that's a different story. But I mean, we got Puppet, we got Chef, and you guys are doing a Docker thing, and it was talked a lot about it at the keynote. What is it? Why is it important? Do we care? Is it a Microsoft thing? Is it a Microsoft clone of Puppet or Chef? Where does it fit in?
How many people have heard of Docker before Monday's keynote? Raise your hands.
The genes.
Yeah.
I've heard of the genes.
Yeah. So very few people raise their hands, so I'll just quickly talk about what Docker is. And to understand Docker, you need to understand what a container is. If you've heard of this container revolution, this is the ability to create an isolated, basically, how many people are familiar with AppV? So those of you that are familiar with AppV kind of have an idea of what a container is. This container technology started on Linux. Google is the company that actually pushed a lot of the initial Linux container technology into Linux distribution starting around 2006, and it's been maturing since then. We believe that Google's running their infrastructure almost entirely on top of Linux containers. And what a Linux container is, it's a virtualized bubble that an application runs in. So it's sitting on top of...
It's a sandbox.
It's a sandbox, right.
Okay.
And it's got namespace isolation, virtualization, so it sees its own version of the file system. You and me as two containers sitting on the same box, can't see each other.
With respect, how is that different from a virtual machine?
Well, it's sitting...
Those are bubbles, too.
So the difference is that this is sitting on top of a common operating system, the shared operating system. So they're all, you and me are sitting basically as application bubbles on top of a common underlying Linux kernel. Sure. So we call the Linux kernel services together. We can't see each other. And then there's a technology called cgroups, which allows somebody to resource isolate the containers if they want to as well, so that you and I, as we consume memory and CPU, we just get the amount that's allotted to us and we can't interfere with each other's usage of those resources.
So in some ways, it's a little like Cutler's vision of what NT was supposed to be, right? The whole microkernel idea was that nothing has any power at all, even drivers. And so in theory, they can't blue screen the system. We're taking
taking that to the extreme.
So it's a new isolation model. An automation model. It's an isolation model.
Yeah, but it goes a step further. So that's the underlying container technology, which is this virtualized bubble with the resource isolation. And Google's their own infrastructure. They've got their own way to create these kinds of Linux containers for their own applications inside. Other people have made use of Linux containers in the past few years, but this company called Docker came out of nowhere basically about a year and a half ago, and they wrote what's called Docker Engine, which is basically an agent that sits inside the Linux machine that a Docker client talks to and tells it, here's a description of the container that I want, and here's the code that I want to run in that container. So the Docker client is controlling this agent that's implementing the Docker engine. And part of the instructions about what to run, of course, include the resource isolation, include the what they want the file system to look at like, but also the code that runs in there. And that code is described as images. And these images can come from what's called a hub, where these images are packaged up, and they're basically zip files that have the binaries and some metadata about the file system structure of those files. And Docker Engine will go pull down the images to the machine if they're not already there. And typically what an application developer will do, or an IT pro, because this is, you don't need to be a developer to take advantage of containers, is create a container that consists of layers of images. And most commonly we see people creating the Ubuntu image as the base layer. The Ubuntu and other Linux distributions basically look different from each other only in the sense of the binaries that come packaged inside of the distro. The underlying Linux kernel technology is very similar.
And the installer.
And the installer,
I mean,
right.
Some of them are far more complex to install than others.
Yeah, the package manager.
The kernel talking about. Exactly, yeah. Yes.
But the underlying kernel is the same, and so people lay down an Ubuntu image, and then they lay down something like MySQL on top of that. The MySQL layer is separate from the Ubuntu layer. So there's two images up in the Docker Hub, one for Ubuntu, one for MySQL, and then one for the customer's own application that they might install into that same container with MySQL on top of Ubuntu. And now that creates the stack, each one with which comes with its own virtualized file system that layer basically compose on top of one another. And the Docker engine's responsible for making sure that it's only pulling down the images that aren't present. The benefits of this, and the reason that this is really taken off and it's like wildfire. I mean, I can't go talk to any customer. I can't go talk to, you can't go to a conference now without hearing people talk about Docker or sessions on Docker.
Really?
And the reason is that it's this agility that, going back to the agility, that people get being able to deploy the applications. You saw in the keynote that I deployed WordPress into a container within a few seconds and got that running as it pulled down the image from Docker Hub. The other benefit of it is because this bubble isolates the application from their surrounding system, I can test my application on my own laptop inside of its container and expect that it'll behave the same way when I push it up into a virtual machine or a physical server someplace else, because it's got the same view. It's got the same view of the files, it's got the same view of the network, it's got the same view of resources, and so you get a lot of predictability out of it. So it's this combination of the dev test cycle is very fast, it's very predictable, and that's what's really caused this thing to go crazy in terms of people being interested in it.
Very good. So the original question I asked you was, okay, if we're gonna do the cloud, why you guys? And so part of that question is, I never imagined that I would like e-books. I never imagined that I would enjoy reading something with a Kindle. I always thought, well, I like the feel of pages and like a real book and that sort of thing. But I've become totally and completely addicted to it, which means that all the books I've purchased in the last 5 years are on Amazon. And if they go under, then crap, I'll have to go find those books again sometime, you know? Actually, my dream is that I should be able to, because I'm moving for the first time in years, and so I'm putting things in boxes, and I have many, many, many books. And my dream would be that I could take any one of my books, tape a dollar bill on it, send it to Amazon, and get an electronic version. I know it's boring, but it's the thing that makes me excited, you know? I don't get out much. So, like you didn't know that. So, but I fear that if Amazon goes under, that, you know, all my books are gone. Why you guys? Why should we believe in you guys? I mean, are you going to be in? Look, let's be very clear. We've heard a number of things of Microsoft in the past that we're going to be forever that weren't. And so, you know, what's the chances that in 5 years
we get bored with the cloud?
Well, it's just not returning the kind of scale. We want to go back to selling Windows. It's an 87% you know, profit rate. Screw this cloud thing.
Let me push that on the stack 1 second. Because I thought you were going to continue about the containers.
What's that?
I thought you were going to have follow-ups on the containers, and I did want to mention one thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All of the containers and the Docker thing has been Linux-based, but one of the things we announced coming in Windows next, whatever we're calling Windows Server,
sure,
is Linux
threshold
is Windows containers. So we're bringing Windows containers technology. That doesn't mean you can run your Linux apps in Windows, but you can run.
Wait.
What?
Docker's in the next version of server?
No. You're not listening.
I said, wait a minute. I wasn't listening, but you know, now you've got my attention.
So virtualization, the ability to layer, the resource isolation,
sure,
we're bringing that to Windows with an API that's compatible with Docker. So that Docker client that I showed running on Windows,
right.
Once Windows Server's out and has the container technology, you'll be able to use that same Docker client to go launch Windows containers on Windows machines, as well as Linux containers on Linux machines. So we're not leaving anybody that's got investments in Windows out of this fun of the container revolution.
So for example, I could create, I'm making this up, a DNS server bubble, and if I had Docker, it's just like I push a button and
yeah, that's right.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Very nice, very nice. So now answer my question, please.
Yeah, okay. I forgot it.
My question.
Oh, yeah, Microsoft.
Let's assume that we think the cloud's a good idea. How come you guys,
Will we get bored and go,
yes? No. What? It's just I've heard that those Amazon people have a cloud that's kind of big, you know? Because people always say every cloud has a silver lining, but that's not true because I'm a pilot and I've flown through clouds, and it's just water. I mean, as it turns out, no, seriously. The average cumulus cloud, I looked this up once, the average cumulus cloud has on the order of 1 billion liters of water in it. So if you think every cloud has a silver lining, the chances are you're all wet. So okay. Anyway.
Yeah, that went over well. So
that's because you scowled. When you scowl, they don't laugh. It's just
like, I've been scowling at all your jokes.
I know that. That's why they're not laughing. No, how come you guys?
So if... One of the things, I know we discussed this the other day, I call this the third era of computing that we're going into, the transformation. You said there's six, and I actually buy your six versus the three.
I wasn't arguing with you, Dr. Rasinovich. I would never disagree with you. Keep talking.
Okay, anyway.
The paying customers out there, move.
Yeah, this third one is the mobile plus cloud disruption, in broad sense is the first one mainframe, the second one client server. This is a huge disruption to Microsoft. This disruption is one that we saw at Microsoft a few years ago. Ray Ozzie, actually, back in 2005, wrote this services memo that he sent to the whole company, which echoed Bill Gates' Internet Tidal Wave memo that went to the whole company that said, the world is moving to services, which is essentially another way of saying the world is moving to cloud, and we better get our butts in gear because our whole business is built on on-prem software delivery. If we don't get on board with this, we're going to see other companies come and they'll start. They won't be as capable. The clouds, you know, the service platforms they create won't be able to do the same things that your on-prem platforms will be able to do. But the benefits that you'll get out of this agility and the elasticity that we've talked about are going to cause this ripping effect of businesses moving to it, and we'll become focused on the past when the future's up in services in the cloud. For a company like, and the history's littered, if anybody's read the book Innovator's Dilemma, history's littered with companies that have been dominant in one phase of their industry that then get disrupted by the small guys that come along.
Well, so hang on, you said that quickly. So you're saying the phrase is Innovator's Dilemma. That's the concept here. And tell us, what does that mean?
Innovator's Dilemma means the company's they've got this profit machine, they've got an efficiency of the whole organization's designed and tuned around delivering this particular service to this particular...
On-premises software.
On-premises software, for example.
Right.
And then they become very protective of it. It becomes very hard to take any resources and divert them away from that, of making that better, polishing the Apple and adding that extra new feature that their loyal customers are asking for, to be able to say, you know, if we don't divert resources to this new thing, we are just going to end up being left behind. So most companies don't make that transition.
So, for example, in our lifetime, we saw WordPerfect, who was the word processor. Windows came along like, why would we do a Windows version? And that's why we don't know.
Yeah. Exactly. companies like IBM that were dominant in computing that are now in services, basically, and not in developing the hardware and software that goes with it the way they used to. We see companies like Digital that are no longer around, that have been disrupted. But it happens across all technology sectors. The Innovator's Dilemma, it's very difficult for a company to have the muscle, the willpower to go fight the desire to preserve the existing business. So it really takes a CEO, first Ballmer, now Satya, to say, we have to let our past go if we want to survive in the future. We have to, it's not like throw it away. It's not like to don't take advantage and don't of the assets we've got, which is the software that we sell to you guys, and have that help us and help you get to the future. But we have to
over-rotate towards the cloud. Otherwise, we're going to have competitors that are not focused, not worrying about on-prem, that are going to be able to out-innovate and outpace us in execution, and then we're not going to end up being around.
Is that really true? I mean, look, you guys have a big checkbook. The number of companies that could actually outcompete you, I mean, you guys could make a really big mistake and toss 100,000 servers to, like, Dynamics or something like that, and if nobody goes with it for 6 months, you say, you're going to live through that.
Well,
Lenovo can't
Let's take a look at another aspect of this disruption that we've had challenge with, mobile. How many people have a Windows phone? How many people have an iPhone or Android device? And then, I mean, I don't even think this crowd's representative of really what's going on out there.
That was a really good number.
Yeah, that was.
These are the faithful here.
Thank you, everybody.
No, because seriously.
But that's one that we showed up late to the game.
No, because I got one as an American, and mine says 0007 on the back of it. So. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's that's one where we showed up a little bit late, and that showing up a little bit late was made a huge, huge difference. We don't want to end up showing up late to the cloud. And, you know,
they haven't answered my question.
Okay, so
my question was, if cloud, why you? You're just saying how great you are. I'm like,
no, I'm not saying. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that explains the behavior that you see. Okay. That explains the behavior of the company that you see.
I'm saying, so I invest a gajillion dollars. I go to your cloud. How do I know that you guys will still be there in 10 years? I mean, look, as an economist, I'm going to say that if you something like the cloud is a perfect example of increasing returns to scale. What does that mean? Well, you know, 120 years ago, we'd be talking about, should we be generating our own electricity or letting some company do it? Well, good Lord, of course we have to generate our own electricity because, you know, our people are the only ones that care about this stuff. The idea of going to somebody else for electricity, that's just nuts, which, of course, is wrong. It's just better to have somebody, maybe a government agency or a big company or something like that. So in the same way, that's what we're doing. We're moving to that. Now, there's been situations where people have trusted an electrical utility and they haven't come through. Not many, but it exists. I'm saying, if I spend all my money to get myself on Google or get myself on Rackspace or Amazon or something like that, we've seen big companies fail.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so why you guys? Why not Amazon?
It's actually, I think, the fact that we do have such a great business with our existing software, with that, I mean, our numbers, you saw the last quarter results, record quarter, great profits. Just mentioned the amount of CapEx that we're spending on data center build-out over the next 12 months.
Yeah.
This disruption, right now the cloud business is a small fraction of our overall revenue and a small fraction of our overall profit. We need to have lots of cash to fund this build-up. Right now, the cloud is in a land grab kind of phase. And
I'm sorry, say it again. What kind of phase?
It's land grab. Basically trying to be, it's just like the mobile wars, to land grab on the mobile wars, because you know that the first mover advantage is massive, or the second mover advantage in some cases is a massive.
So you're saying that this particular market, the winners are going to be the people who have the money up front to develop the land, so to speak.
That's right.
To create an X service and a Y service and a Z service.
And it's investments in the future. They're not going to pay off right now. They'll pay off a little bit later in a big way, right? Once you've got the land sprouting and growing.
Okay, well, that's an interesting supposition, but Amazon's got dough. Yeah. Google's got dough. I mean, these people all have money. I mean, why are you guys going to be the winners here? Or a winner?
Yeah. If, like I mentioned with the last quarterly statements, the profits that we have to go in, push back into the business to grow it out this way. If you look at Amazon's last quarterly statement, they lost $500 million. And
Amazon always loses money. I have no idea how they do it. But
they seem to be losing more and more money these days.
Oh, they're getting better at it.
Yeah.
That's good.
And you saw what happened to their stock after that happened. The investors are basically saying, we don't see an end to this. We need to see at some point where you're going to be generating a profit. Microsoft's generating profits off our existing business while we're investing in the new
one. So I'm trying to refine you here. Yeah. We've only got 30 minutes left, right? So you're saying Amazon, they have issues. It's going to be trouble for them to grow. That's one player. As an economist, I would guess four players. I'm going to say 10 years from now, there'll be four major cloud. That's my point of view. But you're saying Amazon's out. Talk to us about Google. Will Google be around in 10 years?
Google is another company that's got a massive existing business.
with the world's largest advertising company.
Yeah, the world's largest advertising company, right, that they can fund this scale. I mean, they've already at massive scale. They're public cloud. They're going to be able to invest at massive scale. They've got great infrastructure technology. They're going to be able to fund this, you know, this expansion.
So Google's going to be around. Others?
What others? Which other ones would you consider? Anybody else think another massive cloud is going to grow up out of another company? Any other companies?
Facebook.
As a public cloud provider? Not just as an application platform, basically.
It's also a large advertising company.
It is.
So there's a Googlian nature.
But we haven't seen them. I mean, they haven't started as a cloud platform.
So true.
If you look, Azure, Microsoft, Google, Amazon have been working on cloud platform now. If you look, Azure's project, just the Azure focus, public cloud platform started in late 2006. That's eight years.
So essentially you're saying that in 10 years there'll be two players, you and Google.
I'm not saying that.
I'm just a simple country economist, but I thought I heard that. So.
But don't tweet that. That'll get our asses in trouble, okay? So, sorry. Interesting. All right, so let's move along because we only have so much time. And there is a word that we have to talk about that we haven't talked about yet. Security.
Oh, I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up. not in Europe.
Exactly. No, exactly. I have a lot of friends in the IT biz here in Europe, and I hear time and time again, one of my closest friends here is Aidan Finn. You probably saw Aidan speak the other day about virtualization. Great stuff. And Aidan is a man who strongly holds opinions. And he says, you're not going to sell cloud here in Europe because you guys won't buy an American cloud company. And it's not that you don't like Microsoft or Google or whomever. You're just worried about our government. We are too. No, seriously, let me ask. Sorry, how many of you are leery? You like the idea of cloud, but you're a little afraid of an American cloud company. It's all right. We love you anyway. Yeah, I was kind of afraid you'd do that. So along those lines, the other word we have to say with security starts with S is Snowden.
Yeah, that's what I thought you meant when you said security.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll get to the other part.
Yeah, okay.
But I mean, how do you guys respond to that? So I'm a guy that runs a medium-sized business in Europe. It's 2,500 people. Want to come to you guys, and I'm talking to one of you higher-ups in Microsoft to say, well, why should we trust you guys? I mean, if the NSA's got the data, doesn't everybody have the data? Yeah.
If you look at the reaction of American companies to what happened, the revelations that came out a couple years ago.
Tell me what you think, because I don't feel that there's a consensus. Talk to me what you think.
We were shocked. I mean, we weren't surprised, but we were shocked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We were not surprised. Americans were not surprised. We're like, really? It's that bad?
Yeah.
No, seriously. And the thing that bothered me about it largely was, you all know that Mark exposed the Sony rootkit, what, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago? And it's fascinating that, I mean, Sony puts this freaking rootkit on your computer to play their stupid music. And they've never apologized. Sony has never said, we were mistaken. They've never said it's a mistake. They're like, fine, we're just going to keep going. We sell a lot of stuff. Screw you if you don't like it. And the NSA took the Sony model, No, I'm serious. To this day, I'm like waiting for somebody to say, I'm sorry, because we have Obama. He's supposedly our liberal president. And he's like, well, this is not a good thing. And, well, let's move to the next topic, I mean, pretty much everybody. The thing about the NSA that I don't understand, though, is this. If they've got all our data. Now, the joke that everyone had was, hey, NSA, my server crashed. Could I have my data back? Right? No. See, I thought that was interesting. But what I thought was, like, if they're reading everybody's mail, they should be able to analyze it and find me a girlfriend. Now, that's a service. I would gladly pay taxes for that.
That's challenging even for them, I think.
He only
needs some cloud machine learning to help with that.
He's quantum computing. Yeah. He's only known me for 17 years, so he has no idea what we're talking about. So Isn't putting data in your cloud essentially the same as, like, I don't know, making it publicly available?
It's not. And we have no special deals with the U.S. government on turning over data. We've been the most vocal of any company in the United States about our opposition to that policy of...
Oh, come on. No. There isn't a backdoor in BitLocker.
There's no
backdoor. Get out. Seriously? I thought I saw it. Some of my data going out the back door.
No, there's no back doors in anything. In fact, Brad Smith, our head of legal, he has gone to Congress and testified about how bad it is for American business for those kinds of policies to be in effect. We fight regularly the secret orders to disclose data. We refuse to disclose data without notifying the customer that that's being requested of us by the U.S. government. We've got a very high-profile case right now that's based in Ireland, where there's Office 365 emails that the government has subpoenaed that are stored in Dublin data center that we refused to hand over. We've gone to court. We lost the case. And then we were ordered by the judge to turn it over. We refused to turn it over, even though we lost, and are appealing it. And so this is all because there is no cloud. We realize that there is no cloud without trust. There's no cloud without a global cloud. We can't have a cloud that is not addressing European customers.
But, I mean, ultimately, the federal government has the guns, and you guys are based in Washington State, not Texas. Now, if you're based in Texas, I would think that you would have the guns.
Yeah, we're doing...
Keep going. Sorry.
We're doing everything we can to fight and change the policies of the U.S. government with regard to this and to not participate in it.
And that's a frightening thing. We're not just talking about the Microsoft cloud, but any cloud. In the States, it's astounding that if the FBI can show up at a colo place, not even a cloud provider, or a cloud provider, and say, here's a subpoena, we want to see Joe's data. And by the way, you can't tell Joe we saw it. Yeah, that bothers me.
Sealed subpoena. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, you know, if the government comes with guns and says, we want the data, it's like, sure, what the hell, you can have it. But you can't tell the guy. Which is something I like about on-prem, is that when I come home, at least I see that they've broken the door open, you know? So you guys are fighting that. That's a good thing. That's a very good thing. And in the same sense, I mean, I don't know, just speaking as an American citizen, we weren't that surprised that our government was spying on us. It's interesting in Europe that you guys don't think that your government's spying on you. So ultimately, you think the Snowden effects will what? Will simmer down? Or that it'll be forgotten in 3 years? Or?
The interesting thing is there's a big outcry over it, of course, in the United States and elsewhere.
Sure.
But when we talk to customers, including European customers that are looking at moving to the cloud, it is not a primary concern. And most of the time when I'm talking to customers, for whatever reason, these days they don't even bring it up.
Interesting.
And I don't know how much of that is them watching Microsoft's response to it, or they've had time to digest and process what it is and the risk to their business that it actually represents, and said the benefits that we're going to get of moving to the cloud are really outweigh whatever kind of negative impact it might have on us.
Or they've just decided a long time ago that resistance is futile. Yeah. We will control your technology. Yeah. Okay, I got it. So, okay, good. Now, I want to talk to you about something that's near and dear to me. So I'm a Windows Server guy. I like, you know, love Server. I've been writing about it for a long time and whatever. And when I saw the keynote was sort of like Joe Belfiore came out and did a great job showing us the cool new UI stuff. I'm not that interested in UI because I'm a PowerShell guy. You know, I'm not a clicky kind of guy. And how many PowerShell people got out there? Come on. There we go. And then we have the Azure guys come out and say we have 50,000 new something as a service and that sort of thing. And then they said Office 365, we got, what is it, unlimited storage in our whatever. And I was waiting. And like, nothing about server. I'm like, where's my server? I want to know that Windows Server is doing stuff. And I'm really feeling, not from you,
yeah,
but from many Microsoft people, so like, well, what's happening with server? And the Microsoft guys kind of look at you like, you're still doing on-prem? I'm like, well, you got to take that time machine out of your pocket, pal. It's not 2040, you know? And so, I mean, is server going away? I mean, because on the one hand, you guys' story for a while was, okay, you know, the cloud's good. Small companies should be in the cloud because you're crazy to have five administrators in a 250-person company. That was a reasonable argument. But big business, but the idea was that big businesses, well, they're not going to go to your cloud because they've invested in all sorts of things. But that's not changing. You guys have signed up a lot of the Fortune 1000, mm-hmm. right? And Office 365 rules the world at this point. You know, I mean, there's probably more Office 365 accounts than anything else that anyone's paying for, right? Forget Google, yep. that's free. And, I mean, is server going away? Is this on-prem server just a fantasy?
I've got to refer back to our earlier conversation about the innovator's dilemma.
Okay.
And Microsoft looking at where we invest our development resources. Development resources are much more precious than even dollars. And in terms of the amount of volume you can get out of development into a product like that. And so when we're looking at how we invest in server development, we've got to carefully balance, again, polishing the apple, delivering the extra incremental features that will enable companies to be more efficient in their on-prem environments versus the investments that we make in enabling that cloud transition. So some of the announcements that you saw, for example, on Monday were around this cloud platform solution. And that is part of that key approach to enabling you guys to move to the cloud in a way that will be seamless by taking advantage of Azure technologies on premises. And that's the way that we see the bulk of our Windows or server investments is supporting that motion of getting something on-prem that then enables you to go to the cloud. So this consistency of the Azure pack on top of something like Cloud Platform Solution or your own infrastructure, being able to, again, manage and deploy and develop applications in a consistent way across your on-premises data center infrastructure, hosters, or Azure is what we're decided to focus our energies on because that's looking towards the future rather than saying...
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, I thought that this, for me, the single most important announcement that you made on the keynote is something you and I have talked about in the past. I've given you a hard time about the fact that you guys promised that you could have Azure in a box, and then we decided not to, and then we're going to, and it's out.
Yeah.
I mean, you can actually buy a box now where you essentially have your own Azure, you know, one you can put under your desk, which is, I guess, good for development. You could also buy lots more machines and make your own cloud. So that's a...
Yeah.
Can you give us any insight? Why did you guys... I know you were very back and forth about it. Why did you finally decide to do it?
When we were originally were talking about Azure in a box, some of you might have heard of Windows Azure Platform Appliance. We talked about this
for a
while. That was taking the Azure infrastructure software and scaling it down, trying to scale it down to a small enough level that a company of a reasonable size could go consume it.
No. And it was important because, with respect, forgive me for interrupting you, but I knew guys who were small, rack-spacey kinds of guys, and their perspective was, we're going to have our Azure. And we're going to make, because we're following Microsoft, we're going to do what they say, and we're going to build an Azure, and we're going to have our own clients, which I think is a great idea. Because I know that you don't believe in boutique clouds, and I understand what you're saying, but I disagree with you, because people like, for example, the Swiss.
Yeah.
The Swiss have been being the Swiss for centuries because they're the safe harbor. They're the place that nobody else can get to. They're the Cayman Islands, you know, so to speak, sort of stuff. So I believe there will be a small boutique. And if I were the Cayman Islands, if I were the Swiss banks, et cetera, I'd say, well, crap, why should I write the code? Oh, look, Microsoft's going to do it for me. I would think that would be a fantastic little cottage industry.
And I think that we want to help that industry. We want to help that industry. Right. I think... Definitely in the short to medium term, I think I agree with you that there'll be these boutique clouds that serve needs that the larger clouds aren't able to meet.
Okay, so you're very nicely saying I'm wrong. That's okay. But here's the reason I'm going to say you're wrong. How many automobile manufacturers are there? Watch Top Gear. With Top Gear, it's like there's some bizarre guy, you know, out in some place in Britain turning out 30 cars a year.
I don't think the analogy maps. How many mobile operating systems have the majority share of the market?
Well, if it's the majority share, by definition, that would only be one.
Well, all right.
No.
You got me.
No. I'm a little slow. I went to a state school.
Yeah. You know, but a car is not the same as a platform. What we're talking about is not
how many energy
is not
how
not
many
a server.
Energy companies we're not, are there in America.
Yeah, it's not a server. It's not a power plant. But it's a ecosystem. It's a development platform for running applications. It's a little bit different.
Any of those words that you use, I can give you situations where there's more than two of
them. Okay. Okay, well, I guess we'll disagree on this.
Well, no, because my fear about this is this, and this is, you know, this could be tin hat crazy.
Yeah.
So tinfoil hat crazy. But I mean, in America,
but actually, let me throw this back at you. In the computing world, how many mainframe operating systems did you see dominant in the mainframe era? How many desktop operating systems did you see dominant in the PC era?
Three or four.
Dominant.
It's not one. Oh, dominant again. Yeah. You're back to majority. Sorry, only one. I can say this slowly for you.
Yeah. All right, fine.
I mean, I'm not counting BIOS. Okay. OS 2. Those kinds of things. But let's move along.
Yeah.
I mean, which leads to, though, this is really a question. We've only got 15 minutes left, but I mean, something I want to talk is that you guys are all IT pros. And so I asked you, how many of you are a little afraid of the cloud? Should IT pros be afraid of the cloud? What should we do?
I actually don't think that the IT pros should be afraid of the cloud. How many people are happy to be alive right now as we're undergoing this transition? Because I frankly am really excited to be.
If you're not raising your hand and you're not happy to be alive, you should look in the mirror.
No, this is through any kind of disruption like this, the world is changing, and the skills required to adapt to it are new skills. You guys, by seeing this disruption, there's a lot of IT pros that aren't here. There's a lot of IT pros that aren't paying attention to it. There's a lot that are just going about their day-to-day lives and saying, I really like just going to work every morning, punching my card, and doing the same things that I've been doing.
Reset passwords. I reset passwords. That's what I do. Well, no. Hang on. Can I rant for a moment about this?
Sure.
Thank you.
Like I'm going to stop you.
Dr. Rasinovich, for you. No, seriously, when I got started talking about the cloud, thinking about the cloud, a lot of the people that were talking to me were IT pros saying, I'm going to lose my job. You know what I thought about? It's a reasonable thing to ask, right? But then I thought about it, but I realized, you know, it's interesting. Something about us is we're different from the rest of the world. How many of you are doing the exact same thing you were doing 5 years ago? It's all right, you. That's fine. It's okay. Fine. No, seriously. It's like, how many of you remember that 15 years ago, there really were guys at Fortune 500 companies who all they did was reset passwords? Those guys are gone. There's a web page that's doing what they were doing, right? I mean, it's interesting because I'm 57. And when I talk to guys like in their late 30s, 40s, whatever, that are looking at resumes, CVs, and you'll hear, I've had 20 years of experience doing something. The joke is always, did you have 20 years experience or did you experience the same year 20 times? Maybe, are there any managers here? No? Let's talk about them. I mean, how many of you have had technical friends who at some point want more money and what are they? Now, what this guy does is he starts his own company and gets rich and then gets hired by Microsoft. But most people as smart as him end up rising and rising and rising. We can't give you any more money. Become a manager. What a great idea. Stop learning new stuff and become somebody that just controls the carbon units. It's just. In contrast, for us, the sand is always shifting under our feet. And if I had all the money, if I had his money, then in 20 years, I'd do a study of Alzheimer's patients. I'd be willing to bet that IT pros have a much lower incidence of Alzheimer's than almost anybody else because we have to keep learning, we have to keep thinking, we have to keep developing new stuff. I'll give you a quick example. I'll bet every one of you do at least one of the following three things. Ready? Music, cooking, or photography. Is there anybody I didn't get? You know, okay, a few of you. Very few. You know why? There's three reasons. There's three things about that. First of all, you got to learn new stuff. We're used to that. None of us has experienced the same year 20 times and never will. Second, you got to buy toys. We're used to that. And third, you can never perfect it. It's art. It's never perfect, so you always keep going. That's why. That's why I think this is the best job to be in. And I'm just so thankful that you guys let me do it. Okay? Let's keep going. So that's IT pros. How does the cloud affect the IT pros? I'm an IT pro. My job is I'm the exchange administrator. I'm the general administrator. What can I do to keep my job?
Yeah.
How can Azure help me keep my job? Sorry, wrong question. Let me give you one answer.
Sure.
PowerShell.
That's true. Yeah.
Right?
Become a developer. That's what you just said.
Wow. No, that's scary. I don't want to write code.
Mark, look, obviously I can't see sharp.
It's horrible.
They laughed.
Yeah.
Why do you mean become a developer? That's kind of a little nutty.
Well, one of the things that's going on with when you're going to the cloud is automation. It's DevOps. How many people have heard of DevOps at this point? How many people practice DevOps? So if just a few.
Practice it?
Well, you know, yes, you do. That's like anything. If you want to get good at it, you need to practice it. But this, what you're seeing is this acceleration in the change of the software and the change of the systems that are supporting the business as part of this disruption going to the cloud. If you want to participate in it, you need to get on board with this DevOps mentality of supporting the business units in getting to the cloud with their apps. The marketing app, that's something that in the past would take a project to get stood up, a team to get formed. They'd spend 6 months planning it and doing it, and then they'd go and procure over that time, they'd be procuring the hardware and asking central IT to go get it ready to go. And so this big, long, drawn-out process to get something like a marketing app up online for the Windex sales campaign. What it takes now is the marketing team deciding that they want to set up a marketing app, getting some developers, and pushing it out. And literally, we're seeing these kinds of projects go from idea to launch in 4 weeks.
Those are all good ideas, but you're a smart guy, and you have the answer to this question. What should I learn? I can't learn everything.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be a bit of a dev...
Just lost your mind.
Oh, did I? Oh, sorry.
Somewhere.
Oh, here it is.
I can talk loud.
Here
you guys can hear me.
Here it is.
Where did it go? Oh, there it is. I've just gotten started with the speaking thing. It's just... Thank you so much.
Hey, we can't do this without the audio, guys. Thank you.
So are you telling me I should learn C Sharp and F Sharp, Visual Studio, Video? I'm scared.
I think that learning PowerShell as part of the automation of setting up applications that go to the cloud. Okay.
You guys showed us an Azure Batch or something like that?
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, Azure Batch is it's an application platform for scale-out computation.
Well, why not PowerShell? Why did you guys create another thing?
Because I wanted to get back at Jeffrey Snover.
No. That explains it.
He thinks everything revolves around PowerShell now.
He is prettier than you.
But one of the services that we do have live is Azure Automation, which is PowerShell and be able to run PowerShell runbooks in the cloud.
Okay. All right. Really, PowerShell PowerShell doesn't have runbooks. Orchestrator has runbooks.
There are Orchestrator runbooks built on PowerShell.
So you're talking workflow.
Yeah. Well,
are you familiar with these technologies? So you're saying start from PowerShell.
Yeah.
From there, go to the whole workflow foundation, which includes runbooks and all that. I mean, because if you haven't looked at workflows, it's really awesome. Imagine you're creating a batch file that survives a reboot. I mean, think about when you're installing something. You're always like, I want to make the batch file from hell that builds my entire server, but there's three reboots in the process. If you do workflow, it really is just one batch file.
I'll tell you the next step past that.
Okay, please.
Things like you mentioned Puppet and Chef.
Yep.
So those are examples of DevOps technologies, being able to declare your application's needs and then push it out and then have the Chef or Puppet masters go and deploy the application and keep them operating and orchestrate updates to them.
So talk to me about...
And desired state configuration would be the Microsoft technology.
Great. Well, but let me take that step further. So you're saying... I don't know Puppet or Chef, okay? A little bit about them. If you're saying it deploys an app, don't we in PowerShell 5 have the one get whatever the heck it is, the chocolatey stuff, you know? I mean, that I've looked a little bit at that, and that seems pretty easy.
Yeah, that's the kind of equivalent of the Docker Hub, right? This is...
Okay.
I have the application that declares its needs, and that stuff comes pulled down from a gallery on demand at the time it needs it. Same thing as the...
So none of that stuff sounds hard. This isn't C Sharp. This isn't Visual Studio. Yeah. This is PowerShell, which is, by the way, dead easy. Seriously, I mean, you could pick it up.
And so I do want to emphasize this DSC aspect of it, the desired state configuration. How many people have looked at desired state configuration? So this is the this is the philosophy of DevOps and the evolution, basically the first steps towards what the world that we're going to be seeing, which is a declarative world. The past has really been an imperative world. It is one where I write a batch file, and the batch file does step one, step two, step three. If something goes wrong at step two, the batch file is screwed.
I think of desired state configuration as group policies for servers done right.
Yeah.
I mean, think about the beauty of GPOs. Sorry, the promise of the beauty of GPOs. Desired state configuration actually does that, and it's awesome stuff. It's sort of like command line in the passive voice, right?
Right. It's having the system go worry about making things the way that they should be, rather than you worrying about it. And that's everything you see now with DevOps, with this declarative model, including Azure's own PaaS service, including things like Kubernetes from Google. It is a declarative model. It is one where you say, this is the way things should look, and you hand that description to the system, and the system figures out how to make it look that way. And the benefits you get out of that is you get optimizations. The system knows I can do these two steps at the same time. I don't need to serialize them. You're having to mentally do that analysis to figure out how to optimize it. The other thing it can do is handle failures for you. If the server fails, if the application becomes corrupt, the system goes and fixes it for you. You're not sitting there having to write monitoring systems to see is the server healthy? Does the application need to move to another server? Basically writing programs. You're writing a description and then letting the system take care of that for you.
And you don't need System Center for it. It's in the box. It's a reasonable... I mean, seriously, if you're not looking at DSC, please do yourself a favor, because we want you to be here next year. And no, seriously, I mean, I'm going to say what you can't say, is that the cloud is going to affect our jobs in the sense that I'm going to say, I'll be 10 years from now, there'll be half as many IT pros, half as many spots. Doesn't mean you won't have a job. Doing DevOps stuff may be one job. But when they're choosing of the 20 people, the 10 that go, trust me, it's the click, 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 click administrator people that are going to be going. The PowerShell folks, basically, think of it this way. There's a talk that I've got on YouTube, 45 minutes, take a look at it, called The Case for PowerShell, Why You Should Learn PowerShell So You Don't Have to Leave Industry. Okay? All right, so you talked about what devs should do. Let me ask you a hard question. What should you guys be doing? What should Azure be doing? Where should Azure be growing, changing? This is the interview question where I say, you know, what's your great weakness? Well, I just work too hard. I just never go home. You know? what is Azure? And I'm going to kill you if you do that. If I were Amazon or Google listening, there's nobody listening, then, you know, where's the Azure weak points? Where's the number one places or number two places you should be changing?
Versus opportunities to go after?
Good God, you sound like a CTO.
So we do have some gaps now. And one is, those of you that aren't familiar with Azure, this won't resonate with you. Those of you that are familiar with Azure, you'll be saying, yeah, that's a gap. Role-based access control, that's... ability to ACL all the cloud resources in a uniform way with rich policies.
And because in organizations now, something we're thinking more about than we did 14 years ago was I want to be able to say, if this is your job to do the DNS server, that's all you can do. And it's always been very hard to do that in Windows. It's getting better. Forgive me for invoking the name, but Jeffrey Snover and his just-in-time, just-enough administration model is fantastic. I mean, the constrained endpoint stuff in PowerShell, shame you didn't use it in Azure Batch. But that's great stuff. So you're saying GS stuff, the RBAC stuff.
RBAC. Integration of RBAC throughout all our Azure services. That's a weak point that we've just started filling in. We just previewed RBAC for the Azure management plane just a couple months ago. But we need to flesh it out across all of our services.
And you guys kind of have the ability to do that because you're not hindered by the 14-year-old Active Directory.
Right.
You guys have got
We're actually changing Azure Active Directories. We're pushing changes into it.
You guys absolutely are. And it's very interesting for a director services guy to see that you guys are doing things that I've been yelling about for 14 years, that Azure Active Directory, it's really not Active Directory. It's essentially, you know, Atom. But it's, as I said, when we got started, is that the Azure portal changes on an almost daily basis. It feels like you guys have a new build of Azure every 2 weeks or something like that. In the same way, Azure Active Directory has really grown and changed tremendously. I mean, this whole multi-factor stuff that we can do is pretty impressive. So, we've only got about a minute, so I want to ask you guys a question. Is this useful? I know that some of you just want Mark to come and talk for an hour and 15 minutes, and I apologize for having taken time from that. But seriously, was this useful? Is this something we should do again? Do me a favor. I enjoy this. I've known Mark for a long time. We love being on stage together. But if you think there's good stuff and bad stuff, the evaluations are important. Let's be very clear. But feel free to send me an email. I'm just mark@manasseh.com. Drop me an email about what we should do next time. Because I want to do this.
Or shouldn't do, right?
Or shouldn't. Exactly. And then that doesn't include not having me on stage. Yeah,
or Mark not.
Or him.
Yeah. Mark telling fewer jokes.
Oh, he's always like, I could get better evaluations if I could be funny like you are. So, he's such a wiener. Having said that, I only get to do this because Dr. Rasinovich has invited me up to his stage, and I want to thank you,
thank
pal.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And thank you, all of you. And remember to use this knowledge for good and not for evil.
Good job.